Welcome, and thank you for listening to the Jizo An Zen Community's Dharma Talks. We are happy to make these recordings available to you. Please consider making a one-time or recurring donation via the link on our webpage found under Become a Member. We thank you wholeheartedly. Gassho.
So this evening I want to kind of go back to basics. I want to go back to some of the fundamentals. Recently we've discussed a number of very deep topics, including things like no self, emptiness, which can be very, very deep and profound topics. Last week Gendro gave a talk on the very deep and profound teachings of Vasen Badu's Yogacara school. But this evening I want to kind of come back to the basics a little bit, back to the fundamentals of Dharma practice, of Buddhist practice. In Zen, we often talk about coming back. We talk about returning. We talk about taking refuge, which is returning to our home. And so we talk about coming back to the breath, coming back to this present moment, returning to life right in this moment, right here, right now. And so it's important for us to constantly come back to the fundamental teachings of the Buddha, the fundamental teachings of Dharma. And so this evening, I want to talk about a little bit about the Four Noble Truths, which are really, the Four Noble Truths are really the bedrock. They are the foundation of all the Buddhist teachings and really of all schools of Buddhism. I think all or most of the schools of Buddhism, whether you're talking about Theravadan practice, Mahayana practice, Zen, Tibetan, all the Buddhist schools really talk about and really know the Four Noble Truths. Really, it is the foundation of all Buddhist practice, lest we ever begin to think that we already know this teaching perfectly, right? We might have that temptation to know that to think that we know the Four Noble Truths. We've heard this before, we know it well, but the reality is that we are always learning and we always come back to these fundamental teachings. And every time that we do so, I think we can learn something new. Last week, Gendro used the analogy of an ear of corn, how we often see the entire ear of corn, but we don't necessarily see the individual kernel. I think when we come back to the basics, when we come back to the fundamental teachings like the Four Noble Truths, each and every time we can see one of those little kernels. We can see something new. We can hear something new in the teaching. And so the Buddha it's often said that the Buddha early on in his teaching, he said, I teach two things. I teach suffering and the end or cessation of suffering. I think every one of us in this room, everyone online, we all know and experience suffering. We all know and experience discontentment, dissatisfaction, unhappiness in life, perhaps in myriad ways, myriad degrees, from minor discomforts, minor challenges, to really deep, deep loss and grief and even catastrophes. All of us experience suffering. We experience our own personal suffering as well as the suffering of others, both known and unknown individuals throughout the world. We experience suffering in many different ways. And so the Buddha said, or it's said that the Buddha said that he teaches two things and two things only, suffering and the end or cessation of suffering. But I think there was another teaching in that first, that very first teaching of the Buddha, in his first discourse, there was another teaching besides suffering and the end of suffering, and that is the Buddha's middle way. It's often kind of overlooked or forgotten, but that was also a part of the Buddha's first teaching, and we're going to take a look at that a little bit this evening as well. But a common thread that I think you're going to hear this evening that I'm going to kind of come back to again and again is translation of words, or really getting lost in translation. And there's just kind of as an aside, there's a wonderful movie. It's a number of years old now. I don't know if anyone's familiar with this movie, but It's a movie that I like very much, and the movie is called Lost in Translation. This movie stars Bill Murray and Scarlett Johansson. And in the movie, Bill Murray is a very well-known but now somewhat aging American actor, and he's in Japan. He's traveling in Japan, and he's there to film a series of television and print ads because he's endorsing a particular Japanese whiskey, Suntory whiskey. And so there's a wonderful scene that always makes me laugh when Bill Murray's kind of in the studio, and there's a director there and the crew, and they have a translator for him because the director, of course, is Japanese, and they're taking pictures, and there's cameras and lights, and they're filming some excerpts for this commercial. And in the scene, Bill Murray holds up this glass of whiskey, he takes a sip, he's supposed to take a sip, and he says his line, something like, anytime is Suntory time. Right? And they're doing this take, and he says his line, and suddenly the director's like, cut, cut. And the director starts giving instructions, right? But he's giving instructions in Japanese, and he's just going on and on, and he's got this seriousness, and he seems to be scolding almost. And he's going on and on, da 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 da. And this goes on for at least a minute and a half, and boom, Bill Murray's kind of stunned. He's like looking at the director, he doesn't know what he's saying. And he looks to the translator so that the translator can translate for him. And she says, he says, more intensity. Bill Murray just kind of looks at her like, what, that's all he said? I mean, he was so intense himself. He was going on and on. And she says, yes, he says, more intensity. Okay? So this is getting lost in translation. Because I have a feeling that the director in that scene, though I don't speak Japanese, I think he was saying a lot more than more intensity. And so did Bill Murray, apparently, in the scene. But things get lost in translation. They get lost in words. And so, coming back to the Buddha and his first teaching. Prior to his enlightenment, prior to even beginning his journey, I think, towards that awakening, the Buddha also experienced suffering. He experienced discontentment. He experienced dissatisfaction. He experienced anguish. And I think he was moved by this innate compassion within himself, this innate compassion, this innate wisdom, which was already there, which already existed within him. He was moved by that innate compassion, that innate wisdom from the beginning, to really seek out the causes for suffering and how to end suffering or how to go beyond it. And of course, most of us, I think, are familiar with the story of the Buddha. He goes on this journey. He engages in many different types of practices. He engages in these practices of asceticism where he really punishes himself, punishes the body. And of course, none of this really brings him to the answers that he's searching for until ultimately he goes beyond those practices of asceticism, those harsh practices, and he comes to sit under the Bodhi tree. He sits for 7 days, and ultimately he is awakened. He finds the answers that he was searching for. But it's said that immediately after the Buddha's awakening, really, immediately after his enlightenment, the Buddha experienced doubt. He experienced a certain doubt about going forth and teaching what he awakened to. This profound awakening that he experienced, this profound insight, this profound and deep enlightenment. The Buddha experienced doubt about going forward and sharing this with others, teaching it to others. And I love this part of the traditional story of the Buddha's enlightenment. I love this part because it shows that human side. It shows that doubt and that difficulty. Because the Buddha, I think, within himself, he began to think, how can I teach this? How can I share this with others? This deep insight, how can I share this with others so that they will understand? Because what he awakened to was not something that came from outside of himself. It was something that was already within him that he found within himself. And so he wondered, how do I go about teaching this and showing this to others? And I think most of you, if you're familiar with our teachings, you've heard Genjo say many times, he described this practice as being a really crazy practice, a wild practice. Genjo often says this is one of the craziest things that you can ever do. One of the wildest things that you can do is engage in Zen practice. And similarly, I often, like myself, I like to use the word radical, that this is a radical practice. These are radical teachings. Because this really goes against our normal, conditioned, conventional views, how we've typically been told to think, how we've typically been taught to think. And if you look at that word radical, radical is defined in a number of ways. Among them, it says relating to or affecting the fundamental nature of something, revolutionary or progressive, based on thorough or complete political or social change. And then there's this, very different from the usual or traditional, extreme or favoring extreme changes in existing views, habits, conditions, teachings, or institutions. I think that describes this practice pretty well. It describes the radical nature that I see in this practice because it goes against the grain. It goes against how we normally think, how we're normally taught to think by society, by everyone. And so the Buddha, of course, had those doubts and those questions within himself of how do I go about teaching this radical awakening, this crazy wild practice. But of course, I think this was where the Buddha really perhaps used his initial skillful means. This is where his skillful means was born, because he sought to that answer of how to make this teaching, what I have awakened to, what I have experienced, how to make this understandable for others. And so I think that once again, he returned to where he started, that initial, that innate compassion and wisdom that was within him. He was once again moved by that compassion, by that wisdom that was within him, to share what he had found, to share what he had awakened to. Because he knew, he realized that his awakening was not just his, but it was all of ours. It was the Buddha's realization that what was true for him was also true for each and every one of us. This awakening, this innate wisdom is within each and every one of us, just as it was within him. And it's said that the Buddha, upon his awakening, said that I and all beings together simultaneously are awakened. I and all beings together attain enlightenment. And this I that the Buddha was referring to when he said I and all beings, he wasn't just talking about Shakyamuni Buddha. He was talking about all Buddhas and all beings, past, present, and future. I and all beings simultaneously attain enlightenment. I and all beings are awakened. And so the Buddha, of course, decided to go forth and to share what he had discovered within himself, what he had discovered that was within each and every one of us. He decided to go forth and teach what he had awakened to. And this first teaching that the Buddha gave, this first discourse, this first sermon, is known in Buddhist cosmology as the first turning of the wheel of Dharma. And this first discourse he gave at the Deer Park in Banaras near Varanasi. And he gave this teaching to five former ascetics and companions of his. Five ascetic monks who he had trained with prior to leaving that asceticism, those practices of asceticism. He returned to these five former ascetics and companions of his to give his teaching to them. And it's said that they initially they rejected the Buddha and his teaching. I think there was probably a feeling within them of, oh, look at this guy, you know, he didn't quite cut it with us, he didn't cut it in our practices, and he left us. And now supposedly he went off and he meditated and he's awakened now somehow. He's this awakened Buddha. So it's said that the five former companions initially, they kind of reject the Buddha and his teaching. But of course, as the Buddha continues to speak to them, they see something in the Buddha. They see something different. They see something in their former companion, and they continue to listen. They continue to listen to his teachings because something draws them to the teaching, to the Buddha. And so they become that first sangha, that first community of monks to hear the Buddha's first teaching, his first major discourse. And it's often, the Buddha is often described as the original physician because his teachings, much like a physician, he taught what the problem was, what the cause of the problem was. He taught that there was an end or a cessation or a transformation to that problem. And he taught the path to that ending or to that transformation, that cessation of the problem. Much like a doctor will diagnose, let you know what's going on with you, or at least that's what we expect, right? If you go to a doctor and they say, well, the problem is this, come back and see me in 3 months. I think we're all going to be left kind of like Bill Murray in the movie, wondering, wait a minute, there's got to be more than that. But a doctor, a physician will tell you this is what the issue is. They'll tell you whether that issue is treatable, if it's curable, whatever the case may be. And they'll lay out a treatment plan, how to go about treating or curing or dealing with this, whatever the issue may be. And so this first turning of the wheel of Dharma, the Buddha proceeds to teach about suffering and the cessation of suffering and the middle way. And I want to read, this is just a portion of what is known as the Dhammacakka Pavattana Sutta, or Sutra. This is the sutra on the first turning of the wheel of Dharma. And this is the translation from Thich Nhat Hanh. I often turn to Thich Nhat Hanh's translations because they're so clear and simple to understand. And so this is the sutra on the first turning of the wheel of Dharma. This is the beginning of it. This is what I have heard. At one time, the world honored one was staying near Varanasi in Isipatana in the Deer Park. At that time, the world honored one addressed the group of five monks saying, Bhikkhus, there are two extremes that a monk should avoid. What are the two? The first is the devotion to sensual desire and the pleasure resulting from sensual desire. Such devotion is base, pedestrian, worldly, ignoble, and unbeneficial. The second is devotion to harsh austerity. Such devotion is painful, ignoble, and unbeneficial. By not following either of these extremes, the Tathagata has realized the middle way that gives rise to seeing and understanding. This seeing and understanding are at the basis of peace, knowledge, full awakening, and nirvana. What is the middle way, bhikkhus, that the Tathagata has realized that gives rise to seeing and understanding, when that seeing and understanding are at the basis of peace, knowledge, full awakening, and nirvana? It is the Noble Eightfold Path, consisting of right view, right thinking, right speech, right action, right livelihood, right diligence, right mindfulness, and right concentration. This is the middle way, bhikkhus, that the Tathagata has realized that gives rise to seeing and understanding, when that seeing and understanding are at the basis of peace, knowledge, full awakening, and nirvana. Here, bhikkhus, is the noble truth of suffering. Birth is suffering. Old age is suffering. Sickness is suffering. Death is suffering. Sorrow, grief, mental anguish, and disturbance are suffering. To be with those you dislike is suffering. To be separated from those you love is suffering. Not having what you long for is suffering. In other words, to grasp the five aggregates as though they constitute a self is suffering. Here, bhikkhus, is the noble truth of the cause of suffering. It is the desire to be born again, delight in being born again, attached to the pleasures found in this and that. There is the craving for sense pleasures, for becoming and for not becoming anymore. Here, bhikkhus, is the noble truth of ending suffering. It is the fading away and ending of craving without any trace. It is giving up, letting go of, being free from, and doing away with craving. Here, bhikkhus, is the noble truth of the path that leads to the end of suffering. It is the noble eightfold path of right view, right thinking, right speech, right action, right livelihood, right diligence, right mindfulness, and right concentration. And so this was part of the Buddha's first teaching, his first discourse, this first turning of the wheel of Dharma, of these four noble truths. And I want to say a few words on this word itself, again, translation, this word noble, because it is believed by some to be, by many, to be a mistranslation of the original word. And it's often said that the word is really, it isn't that the truths themselves are noble. We hear the four noble truths. But the translation is really not completely correct. And it's said that it isn't that the truths themselves are noble, but rather that those who come to understand and realize these truths are noble. That understanding is ennobling, or what makes the truths noble. So they can really, the better translation may be that they are the four ennobling truths. And there's a slight difference in the earlier Theravadin view of the four noble truths and of this word noble. Because in the Theravadin view, they saw it as kind of there being four stages on the way to awakening, to nirvana, which begins with a stage that they call the stream enterers, those that begin to have an insight into the four noble truths, and then it proceeds through three other stages on the way to nirvana. But the Mahayana saw it in a slightly different view. The later Mahayana, which includes our tradition, Zen, and it includes Tibetan Buddhism, saw a slightly different perspective, because in the Mahayana tradition, all beings are said to have innate Buddha nature. All beings, then, for these truths, lead all beings to noble attainment. So the Mahayana saw it slightly different from the Theravadin view, in that in the Theravadin view, it seemed like they felt like you had to start progressing through these stages in order to be considered noble. Whereas in the Mahayana view saw it more from the perspective of all beings have innate Buddha nature. All beings have this awakening within them. And so all beings can attain this noble attainment. And so the four noble truths are really seen as being kind of like part of the raft that takes all of us, that takes all beings to the other shore of awakening or realization. It is a part of this raft that we use to cross to the other shore of awakening. And so we examine the four noble truths, beginning with the first noble truth, which was called dukkha. This word dukkha, and again, we go back to being lost in translation. Because often, most often, dukkha is translated simply as suffering. Right? The Buddha taught that life is conditioned by suffering, or pain, or misery. This is often how that word is translated. So it's often seen as being just plain deep suffering or pain or misery in life. And so people hear that, and of course they think that this is a very nihilistic teaching, that it's very, you know, it's a very negative teaching that all life is suffering. But really the translation of that word is a bit different. The translation is more, it's said that it's more of a wheel being out of kilter, like the wheel on a cart being out of kilter, so that the cart doesn't quite run smoothly. Right? It's translated as being not just suffering or pain or misery, but as dissatisfaction, as discontentment, as challenges that we all experience in our life, as unhappiness. So this word dukkha takes on a far greater meaning than just suffering or pain or misery. So, and already contained in this word dukkha, when we examine that word, already contained within the word dukkha is the other side of that coin, what is known as sukha, or happiness, contentment, and joy. And that is already contained within that word dukkha. And it's not its opposite, rather it is the other side of that same coin. Because when we have dukkha, there is also sukha, and vice versa. There is pain, there is discontentment in life, there is dissatisfaction and unhappiness, but there is also joy, there is also happiness. And they are the two sides of that coin. And in teaching about this first noble truth, the truth of suffering or discontentment, it said that there are really three categories of suffering that we experience, three general categories of suffering. The first is often known as, just plain and simply, the suffering of suffering. Those things that we have very little or no control over. Things, of course, like aging, sickness, and death. These are things that no matter, I mean, we can take care of ourselves, take care of our health, eat well, exercise, etc. But ultimately, we all experience aging. We all experience sickness in our life, and we will all experience death. Right? These are forms of suffering that all of us experience and that we have little or no control over. That is the first category of suffering. The second category of suffering is the suffering of change. The suffering of change. Because all things are subject to the law of impermanence. All phenomena are constantly changing. There is nothing that is fixed and unchanging. And we suffer as a result of this. Human beings suffer as the result of change. Because we fight against change. We don't like change. We like for things to remain as they are. We grasp on to things and we want things to continue just as they are. And on the flip side, when we don't like something, then we want that to be other than how it is. But there's always that suffering of change, right? That suffering of change, it's like even when we get or have what we want, we know that it won't last, that we can't hold on to it forever, that we can lose it. And so we suffer as a result of that form of change. So we either want what we don't have and we suffer because we don't have it and we want it, or we suffer because we have what we want, we get what we want, but we immediately feel like we can't hold on to it. It will change, I won't be able to hold on to it forever, or it won't remain this way forever. And we experience this in many different ways. And I've given the example in the past of, I'm sure I'm not the only one. Has anyone else ever had, like, when you're looking forward to perhaps a vacation, a getaway, you want to go somewhere nice and you're really looking forward to being there, or you're really looking forward to get to a little bit of time away from work, and then you get to this place that you were going to go to, perhaps an island somewhere or whatever it might be, you get there, it's beautiful, and one of the first things that we think of is, this is going to go by so quickly, and I'm going to be back at work on Monday. Right? We just arrived to this thing that we were so wanting, feeling so good about, and one of our first thoughts is about losing it. It's not going to last. I won't be able to stay here indefinitely. I got to get back to the grind. And so we cause suffering. And then the third category of suffering is what's known as typically as universal or all-pervasive suffering. And this is often the most subtle form of suffering and the most difficult to see. This all-pervasive suffering. This is where we create our own suffering, our own discontentment and unhappiness. Just like in the example that I just gave. We create that suffering. And this can be the most subtle form, because with the first form, sickness, aging, death, we kind of all see that. We know the suffering of that type of, the suffering of suffering. And when we really examine change, we can begin to see the suffering of change, how we suffer because of change. But this all-pervasive suffering, this kind of this undercurrent that so many of us have, this general background feeling of anxiety, of fear, of insecurity, this feeling of that we lack solid ground to stand on. And we even question the reason for our existence sometimes. Why are we here? Why am I even alive when this world just sucks? It's just so painful. Right? There's this undercurrent, this general background feeling of suffering. And so often we cause so much of our own pain, so much of our own suffering because of this all-pervasive suffering. But from a Buddhist standpoint, these doubts that we often experience, these feelings of anxiety or fear or insecurity, this feeling that we lack solid ground to stand on, that we lack anything solid to hold on to, from a Buddhist standpoint, these doubts can really be instructive. They can be the doorway to wisdom. And this kind of leads us to the second noble truth, that suffering or dukkha has a cause. And it's often referred to in Buddhist teachings as a thirst, that we have this constant thirst, right? This desire, this wanting. And the two primary causes, the Buddha taught, the two primary causes of suffering are attachment or craving or aversion. It's the other side of it. And ignorance, right? This not clearly seeing or this willfully looking away. Right? And attachment, when we talk about attachment or craving or wanting, this attachment not only includes attachment to material things, attachment to people, attachment to sense pleasures, but it also includes our attachment to ideas, to concepts, to views, to opinions, to conditions being a certain way. Attachment to ideals. We become very attached, very fixated on our opinions, our ideas, our views. So this attachment, this craving, this grasping on and not wanting to let go is one of the primary causes of our suffering. And then there's ignorance. We suffer because of this fundamental ignorance. We suffer because of this very mistaken belief, this very mistaken delusion that we exist as a completely separate self, as an independent self, as a solid and fixed and unchanging I or self. Right? And we desperately want to hold on to that. We want to hold on to this self that we think is myself. I think I want to always be this way. And I'm never going to be something different. I'm always going to be me. I'm always going to be me, right? Most of us think that way. I'm not going to change. I'm always going to be me. Whether I'm 25, whether I'm 50, whether I'm 75, I'm me. And that's not going to change. Except what is this me that we're referring to? What is this fixed and unchanging me, this fixed and unchanging self that we refer to? Are you the same person that you were when you were 15, when you were 20? Am I the same person that I was when I was 25, 30, 35, 40? I'm not that same person. I'm not the same person that I was yesterday, because we are always changing. There is no fixed, unchanging self that we hold on to that never changes. We constantly experience change in our lives, but we fear that change and we desperately want to hold on to this self that we think we are. And then maintaining that delusion, that is samsara. That is remaining trapped in this cycle of suffering, of discontentment, of dissatisfaction. Because we're working so hard to maintain this delusion of a fixed, unchanging self. We work so hard to maintain this illusion that we can have these things and hold on to them forever, and that we won't lose them, and they won't change. And that that constant working on that delusion is the wheel of samsara. We're constantly trapped in this wheel of constant suffering. The third noble truth, the cessation or the ending of suffering. And once again, we go back to Lost in Translation. Because that word cessation is probably not the best translation of the third noble truth. It's often translated that way as the cessation of suffering or the end of suffering. But if we look at the first noble truth, we know that the Buddha said all life is conditioned by this dukkha, by this general dissatisfaction and discontentment. In other words, it's always present in one way or another throughout our lives. We experience it throughout our lives. Thich Nhat Hanh uses the translation of that word. He says transformation. It isn't the cessation necessarily or the ending of suffering, as if we'll reach a point where we no longer suffer. That if we practice hard enough, if we train hard enough, if we do enough zazen, we'll reach this enlightened state, this awakened state, where we no longer suffer. But I don't think that's possible. But transforming our relationship with that suffering, with those thoughts that we experience, this is possible. We can transform how we view suffering, how we receive it in our lives, and how we respond to those difficulties and those challenges in our lives. This is the cessation of suffering that the Buddha spoke of. Not that suffering would end, that you would no longer experience it, that you would just completely end it and no longer experience any suffering for the rest of your days, but rather that we can reach a cessation of how we cling on to that suffering, how we create it for ourselves, how we remain trapped in that cycle, in that wheel of samsara, of suffering, of discontentment. We can transform how we receive it and how we respond to it. This is really the cessation of suffering, the transformation of suffering. And in the fourth noble truth, the Buddha spoke of the path that leads to the transformation of suffering. That path is the Noble Eightfold Path. And the Noble Eightfold Path really speaks to the Buddha's middle way. This was the middle way between that attachment, that aversion, that grasping, that constant wanting, that thirst, and completely trying to avoid suffering, trying to deny suffering. The path, the Noble Eightfold Path, taught the middle way. And when we look at the Noble Eightfold Path, those aspects of the path, right understanding or right view, right thinking, right speech, right effort, all of the aspects of the path. That word right, we see that word right. And again, the translation. Right? Because oftentimes when we see that right view, what is right view or right understanding? We automatically think that it's right as opposed to wrong. There's a right view and there's a wrong view. There's right speech and then there's wrong speech. There's right effort and the wrong effort, etc. But that word right in the Buddhist path, it's really not right as opposed to wrong. But what that word right means is what is most conducive, what is most in harmony, what is most beneficial for awakening, for liberation, for the transformation of suffering. What is most conducive to that way that leads to liberation, that leads us to going beyond or transcending or transforming the suffering and the discontentment that we experience in our lives? So it's not just right versus wrong, but simply what is most in harmony with awakening, with realization, with liberation. What is most skillful? And we speak in Zen all the time about skillful means, about employing skillful means. And skillful means goes beyond what is simply right or wrong. Skillful means is what is needed in this moment, based on these circumstances, based on this individual. What is needed? This is what the Buddha looked at when he decided to go forth and teach after his awakening. When he had those doubts, and when he stopped and thought to himself, how can I do this? How can I explain this to others, what I have experienced within myself? How can I go forth and teach this to others? They're going to think I'm absolutely nuts. Or they're going to think I'm a narcissist, that I'm saying I'm awakened and no one's going to understand. But he went forth with skillful means. He looked at what is most beneficial, what is most skillful, what is the most skillful way that I can present this, that I can share this with others so that they can understand that they too, just like me, all beings can attain enlightenment, can awaken, can reach this realization. And so this middle way, this path of skillful means, the path of the middle way, is that way between the absolute and the fixed extremes. And so I don't want to go into all the aspects of the Noble Eightfold Path. That would be an entire another talk. We could talk about that for an hour or more easily if we go into all of the aspects of the Noble Eightfold Path. But I do want to touch on the first aspect of the Noble Path, of the Noble Eightfold Path, which is right view or right understanding. Whenever the Noble Eightfold Path is taught, it always, or typically always, begins with right view or right understanding. Because right view or right understanding really gives rise to the other aspects of the path. To right thinking, to right speech, right action, right livelihood, right effort, right mindfulness, right concentration. They all proceed from that right view or right understanding. And what is that right view or right understanding? It is the understanding of our true nature, of reality or of life as it really is. And this goes back to the Four Noble Truths. Right view or right understanding is that understanding of who we truly are and how life really is. Realizing and understanding, recognizing the universal truth of suffering. Suffering is known as one of the three marks of existence, along with impermanence and no self. Suffering and its other side, nirvana. That recognition, that realization of how suffering is intertwined with reality as it is, with life as it is, because it is always present. Life is conditioned by this dukkha, by this dissatisfaction, by this all-pervasive unhappiness, this undercurrent of dissatisfaction that we all experience. And so that right understanding of how life and reality truly is, this is right view or right understanding. And to transform, to be able to transform our suffering, to realize liberation, we first need to recognize our suffering and the fundamental cause of our suffering. Why do we suffer? What is the cause of the suffering, of the discontentment, the dissatisfaction that we experience? This attachment, this craving, this aversion, and ignorance, a not understanding, a not clearly seeing, or willfully looking away from and denying what we truly are, what life truly is. And while some forms of suffering, some form of discontentment are more obvious and easy to see, we have to train the mind to recognize those more subtle forms of all-pervasive suffering that come from within ourselves, the suffering that we tend to cause ourselves. It takes training the mind to begin to see, to see with greater clarity where we become stuck, how we cause our own suffering and our own discontentment, recognizing how our own attachments, our own desires, sometimes insatiable, sometimes inflexible. Those attachments and those desires, how they cause us to remain stuck in the cycle of samsara, in this cycle of unhappiness, of pain, of dissatisfaction. And this is where practice comes in. Because meditation, zazen, allows us to cultivate that right understanding, that right view, rather than the misunderstanding that's born of desire, that's born of attachment and ignorance. Meditation allows us to take that pause. It allows us to take that pause and to really examine what we normally never examine. How is it that I suffer, and what are the causes of my suffering? How am I causing my own suffering? And this transformation, of course, is not easy. It takes continuous practice. This just sitting still, we talk about just sitting, this silent illumination that we practice. This just sitting still, this watching our mind with non-judgmental awareness, not allowing ourselves to be bothered, to be overcome by our thoughts, but seeing them as exactly what they are, as just that, just thoughts. This is where the practice comes in. This is where that silent sitting allows us to see those thoughts with greater clarity, and to see them as just thoughts, thoughts that come, thoughts that go. And in our practice, we train the mind to not chase after our thoughts. To not chase after our thoughts, which is attachment. Not running away from our thoughts, which is aversion. And not willfully looking away or avoiding or denying these thoughts, which is simply ignorance. We train in looking at all of our thoughts and seeing those thoughts for what they are. So I want to read just a small excerpt here before I close. It said, Shariputra once said, all skillful dharmas fall under the Four Noble Truths in the same way that the footprints of all land animals can fit into the footprint of an elephant. These truths not only provide the framework for understanding everything else that is skillful, but also give directions for how to deal skillfully with whatever arises in our experience. Suffering is to be comprehended, its causes to be abandoned, its cessation to be realized, and the path to its cessation is to be developed or cultivated. In this way, the Four Noble Truths is the Buddha's most overarching teaching, the teaching that puts every experience in its place and tells you the most skillful way to shape your experiences into a path. So to see ourselves within this framework of the Four Noble Truths, to see ourselves within these universal truths, to see our own life experience, our everyday life experience, to truly see it within these Four Noble Truths, this is ennobling. It ennobles us. It is a noble act that we engage in. It is right view. It is right understanding. It is virtuous, and it is what is conducive to awakening, to our true self, to awakening to life as it truly is, to reality as it truly is. It ennobles us to see how life is on a daily basis, and to see how we can transform that suffering, how we can transcend it and not allow those thoughts that keep us stuck in this wheel of suffering, how we can begin to transform how we receive those thoughts and respond to those thoughts. It is one of the most noble acts that we can engage in, to see our life within the Four Noble Truths.